This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Luis Garay. He's an artist, illustrator, and author of several books. He's from Nicaragua, and he's at the Santa Fe Art Institute for the coming days. And Cristian Villela, who is a professor of art history at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Luis has an exhibition called Creation Myths of Mesoamerica, Popol Vuh and Quetzalcoatl, which opens this Friday, the 6th of May, at 5 o'clock at the Santa Fe Art Institute. It's on view for the entire month of May, well, through the 27th. And on the 12th of May at 7 in the evening, there is a conversation between Cristian and Luis called The Intersection of Mythology and Immigration. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your life and your work, Luis. You grew up in Nicaragua, and then you were, as a young adult, in Costa Rica, and then moved to Canada. Mm-hmm. What was your connection to indigenous Mesoamerican stories and culture when you were a young person?
It happened in Toronto, actually. Of course, I'm from Nicaragua, but you know all these cultures because we study in elementary school, in high school, about the Mayans, the Aztecs, and you have some knowledge about that. But when I became an illustrator, it happened in Toronto, being there. It was like a Cinderella story by an accident.
What happened?
When I got there, I started to make contacts with galleries and some people who were involved in art. And I met a gentleman who became like my grandfather, Charles Stothers. And he has many friends. And because he was so nice, so I decided to give one piece to him. And he immediately framed it and hang it on the wall. And suddenly, next week, a publisher came to visit him, and he saw this painting. He said, "Who's this artist?" Because it was different. He has a lot of flowers in the living room, and this one is a barrio from Nicaragua, okay? And he said, "He just came. He's settled in Toronto. He wants to make a career like an artist." And he said, "Oh, I need to talk to him because we can make a children's book together." So he made contact, and he called me once, twice. At the third time, he convinced me to work for children's books. Why? I refused this opportunity because we didn't have that culture when I was a child in Nicaragua. Now things are changing because I'm back home working on a library and things like that, promoting literature for children. But in my time when I was a child, we didn't have children's books. So for me, when he was asking me to do a children's books, I didn't understand or I didn't know the dimension of the industry that exists in Western world. And so at the end, he asked me to take it like a challenge. And that's how The Long Road came out. It's about immigration. It was my first book. A lot of mistakes in that book, but it happened. It happened.
What do you mean mistakes?
I mean, like, because I didn't have an idea about how a children's book work in the structure. The story and then the text, the illustrations. So when I came with these ideas to do the book, to start with the sketches, he said, no, this is not working this way. Oh, I told you, I can't, I'm not going to do it. And he said, no, just be patient. So I'm going to explain you. And he explained me. And then I realized, and then my brain worked and said, okay, I got it. So when I come back with the next sketches, he said, I knew it, this was for you. So so now I have several books from that time.
And how did you get involved with the images and the books around the Mesoamerican mythologies?
I started to work with Patricia Aldana. She found me in the Bologna book fair, being in Toronto. Patricia lives in Toronto too. She's from Guatemala, actually. And she had a publisher, a small one. And she started to have an idea that she was just publishing just books for Anglo people. But being Guatemalan, she wanted to do something about her roots. And then she found me, an illustrator working in Toronto, and he's Nicaraguan, and we are very close, we are neighbors. So then she called me, and she offered me to do the first book that's called Jade and Iron, La Piedra y el Metal, we translated in Spanish. Okay, and it was a group of legends from before the colonization and then after the colonization. So when this book was finished, she said, okay, I want to continue working with you, but I have a new project for you. Okay, let's talk about it. So we want to do a book about Rubén Darío, the poet from Nicaragua, actually. And we start to look for short stories of Rubén Darío and the poetry. But Rubén Darío, most of his work is developed in Europe because he was living there. He was an ambassador of Nicaragua in France, okay? And he developed many of the poetries based on that culture. So we didn't do that. We wanted to get into the Latino market, okay, in United States, Canada, or Latin America. And because it was industry that was growing in at that time, in the 90s, for example. And she said, how about if we do the Popol Vuh? And I said, okay, yes. I said, just like that. And I didn't have any idea how much work that book's has. And okay.
Well, tell us about, well, maybe you, Kristan, can tell us a little bit about the Popol Vuh. What is this text?
The Popol Vuh is essentially a creation text of the ancient Maya. And the version that we have today was written down just after the conquest in Quiché Maya, but it was which is a language of Maya that's spoken in the Western Highlands of Guatemala. And it was almost certainly transcribed from a codex, a pictorial manuscript, into Latin characters, because the Spanish were pretty keen on destroying all those pictorial manuscripts, because they, even if it was a medical text, it was completely full of deities and the kinds of things they didn't want new Catholics to be taking a look at anymore. And so the text was written down, and then it was lost until the 1860s. When it was found in a library in Guatemala by a French explorer and writer named Abbé Brasseur de Bourbourg. And he published in the 1860s in France.
Now, when you talk about it was transcribed, what was the nature of the original text that was lost? How much do we know about it?
The original text was not a text as such. It was basically what we would think of as a picture book. And it was on an accordion fold manuscript, probably painted on fig bark paper, and then gessoed and filled in with images and probably some hieroglyphic texts. But many of these ancient Maya manuscripts, and four of them exist today, four of them survived the conquest, are an interesting mix of text, Maya hieroglyphics, and images. And the ones that we have that survive are all manuscripts that are about the calendar and also about divination. But we know that there would have been medical texts and historical texts and mythological texts, and the Popol Vuh is one of these. And so a Quiché Maya prince, a noble, wrote this, transcribed the text from a more pictorial format to a European-style text.
Because this Quiché Maya prince had become multilingual, essentially.
Absolutely. And also, as I mentioned a minute ago, there was danger in having one of these pre-Columbian manuscripts, because if you owned one, then you could be prosecuted by the Inquisition. And so most of those manuscripts were burnt at the time of the conquest, and only a couple of dozen of them exist in the world. And
how did they survive?
Just by chance. And so we don't know where the original pictorial version of the Popol Vuh, what happened to it. It was probably destroyed after he wrote the text down.
Yeah.
We don't know where he's in.
But the other ones that survived were sent to Europe as gifts and circulated around the great collections in Europe in the 16th century through the 18th century. And some of them have unknown histories about how they got to Europe. And a few of them are in Latin American collections. There was just one that was discovered in a cave in Mexico in the 1960s.
Oh, my goodness. And it had survived because the climatic conditions inside the cave were kind of inert?
They were very dry.
Yeah. So now these texts are no longer considered dangerous, or what would you call it?
Heretical.
Heretical. And are studied by scholars and read in high school by students like you, Luis.
Yes.
What is the content? This is a creation story. Is it equivalent to, like, the Bible?
Well, let me tell you a bit about it. The Popol Vuh is like the Ramayana or the Mahabharata. It is like the Odyssey of Homer. So it is a creation saga that takes us from the creation of the universe all the way down into the lives of living people. So the Popol Vuh begins, has a mythological section, and then by the time you arrive at the end of the book, you have people who were alive at the time the book was written down. The great families in Western Guatemala are connected to the acts of the gods in the same way as living families and some of the Indian epics are connected to the workings of the great gods in the Ramayana.
Creation stories, creation sagas are fascinating in many ways, and one of them is what they have in common with one another. Walk us through the kind of beginning of the creation story of the Popol Vuh, and how is it like and how is it unlike other creation stories that we might be familiar with?
Well, my work is visual, actually. I had to read all these books and some other books to try to understand the concepts of the book. Okay, it's not like a historian. I am an artist. But it's when I was studying the figures and the codex of the Mayans, because I had to go with a loop.
Magnifying glass, yeah,
yes,
very
yes,
closely.
Yes,
yeah.
Because little details, little things that you can see in the book. And you start to see the Egyptians, and there's a lot of similitude on the things that they wore, okay, in the way the dress ups, the things that you put on the around the neck, on here, on the wrist, and things like that. And I realize, oh my goodness, must be something in common through the years behind, you know. It's because they look similar for me, and even the way that they represent the murals is in two dimensions. They never work in three dimensions. They always work flat. I mean, two dimensions. It was easier for them to work, I think. It didn't exist three dimension at that time. So this, I found a lot of similarity on those two cultures. And then when you read other books related to, because I had to study this, some authors make reference to mythologies like the Greeks and things like that. Okay, and to compare that this is happening in the century, century, I don't know, long time ago. And the Popol Vuh has some part that's are similar. For example, when the princess Ixchiq get pregnant, okay, everybody relate this to the Virgin Mary, because this is like, it's not an angel who came to, okay, but there is a hell that's cut or one of the twins, and he's put in the trunk of a tree or the squashes who doesn't give any fruit. So when they put that head on the trunk, so the tree start to give the squashes, okay, and it was prohibited. So this came this.
What was prohibited?
To see the tree, and to cut any fruits from the tree. And this princess came because she heard the story, and she was so curious, and she came to see the tree, and she started to talk to the skeleton, okay, and the head just throw a kind of saliva to her, and she stayed on the palm on her hand.
So a right skeleton one. Head drooled saliva on her hand.
Yeah.
And she got pregnant.
Yeah, just like that. So, and so some people relate it to the Bible, for example.
Right.
Well, the story also begins, that's about part of the way through the story, and it begins a little bit similar to what we see in the book of Genesis. So there is a section at the very beginning where the darkness is upon the face of the deep, and there is a kind of prime mover that creates the universe at the beginning of the Popol Vuh. And after that is created, then the waters are separated from the earth, and the sky is created, and the four directions are set up. And the language they use for the establishment of the world is very similar to the language that Maya people use when they lay out a cornfield or a milpa. So it's the same kind of squares and corners and thinking about marking out space, but just on a kind of cosmological scale is how the gods do it. A common feature of many world cosmologies, or actually this is a cosmogonic story, creation story, is you oftentimes have demigods who have to defeat these kind of prime forces. And the demigods in the Popol Vuh are the hero twins. And there are several sets of twins in the Popol Vuh. And mainly there's an older set named Hunhunapu and Vukupunapu, which in Quiché Maya means one hunter and seven hunter. That's their calendar names, like as if his name was May 6, for example, in our calendar. And they're there are the Hero Twins, and in the story, they're summoned down to the underworld because they're making too much noise playing the ball game. And so the lords of of death and decay and chaos summon them down to the underworld to play the ball game. And that older set of Hero Twins is simply, they're not crafty enough. The lords of the underworld defeat them quickly, and they're sacrificed. One of them is buried in the ball court. The other one has his head is decapitated and put his head, as Louis said, up in a calabash tree, where it turns into a skull. And as he mentioned, there was the daughter of the lords of the underworld, and it was forbidden to approach this calabash tree, and she did, and she had an interaction with this skull on the tree. And
so it was the skull of one of those original Hero Twins
who impregnated her by spitting into her hand. And then, of course, there was great uproar in the underworld because the daughter of the lord of the underworld has become pregnant, and we have to find out who is the father. And eventually they decide that she's going to be sacrificed and banished to Earth. And in the end, she escapes and goes to Earth and befriends the mother of the Hero Twins, so the grandmother of the twins that are in her womb, she befriends.
So she's having twins.
She has a second set of twins. And
what I understood, I don't know if you correct me because you're a historian. It's for example, the twins is because of the ball game. They play this game in just couples. I mean, 2 against 2, 4 against 4. And that's why they use the. But at the same time, there is the duality of life. The dark, the day. For example, those dots that you see in the Amazing Twins, that represent the moon. And the other one has the jaguars, spots.
Jaguars, yeah.
Like tattoo. This represents the sun, okay? It's the day and the night. So that's all the concept.
Yeah, Luis is right. The ball game was practiced by, played by all these Mesoamerican peoples, mm-hmm. from the Mayas to the Aztecs to the Toltecs. And it was
Toltecs.
Played both as for sport and also as a sacred game. Uh-huh. So there was a lot. When Cortez and his men came to Mexico in the early 16th century, they saw a great deal of gambling on the ball game in Mexico City. But there were also very sacred games, sacred forms of the game in which people were put into the game who could not win. And as soon as they were defeated, their heads were chopped off. So it was a kind of a location of sacrifice. But the ball game, as you say, was also a kind of solar metaphor, with the ball flying across the court, being likened kind to the sun. So the boys were great ball players when they grew up. And they too started making an awful big racket on the roof of the Lords of the Underworld on the ground. And they were summoned to play against the same Lords of Decay who had destroyed their fathers, who had killed their father and their uncle. But this set of Hero Twins was much, much craftier.
They were more smart, more intelligent.
And the Lords of the Underworld tried again and again and again to defeat them on the court and also to give them these trials that they had to undertake at night. So one night they had to go into a house of death bats, where these giant vampire bats were threatening them, and they figured out they hid in their blowguns overnight. Another house was the house of jaguars, in which there were these very hungry jaguars and who were threatening to eat them all night. And what they did is they gave them the bones of animals and said, henceforth, you animals will be able to have the bones of all creatures. And so leave us alone, in other words.
Right.
So every one of these tasks, these trials, it's a kind of what in mythology is called a harrowing of hell.
And they pass all of them, yeah.
Yeah, and in the end, they realize that the lords of the underworld have a plan that they cannot get past. And so the lords of the underworld have created a giant bonfire. And the Hero Twins, the second set of Hero Twins, whose names are Hunapu and Spalanque, have decided that we have a plan to come back from the dead. And so they hurl themselves, they immolate themselves in this giant fire. But they have a plan. They come back as fishermen after their ashes are scattered in the sea.
Die in the fire, but they know they're coming back as fishermen.
Yes, and then they ingratiate themselves to the lords of the underworld, and then they start doing tricks and dances and doing a magician's act where they kill people and bring them back to life. And they kill a dog and they bring it back to life. And they kill a flunky of one of the lords of the underworld and bring it back. And finally, the lords of the underworld are so excited by this. They're so animated by these hero twins that they say, well, now you have to do it to us. Kill us and bring us back.
There's a trick.
And what do you think happened? They killed them, but they did not bring them back.
And so what happened then?
The hero twins defeated the lords of the underworld. And then they walked into the sky and became the sun and the moon.
Yeah, they tried to cling before the creation of the first man. In this case, there's the corn, the people of mice.
The people of the corn.
Yeah, and they tried to cling. That's the idea of the two main gods, the corazón del cielo, corazón de la tierra.
Heart of sky and heart of earth, yeah.
Yeah, they created these twins because of that, to try to, they knew that they were going to be smart, very intelligent, and they could defeat these people from Xibalba. And some other stories, like the giant part of the Pukuka Kicks, the seven Macau, they send them to try to punish them because they are very proud to be, because they have a lot of pretty jewelry and things like that, a lot of richness. But they think that they own all those areas where they point out through the horizon, okay? And so the twins came to try to punish them and to defeat them, actually, to this giant and the two sons who are in the story of the Popol Vuh too. So the idea was to clean the evil before the first man was created. And sorry, I want to add something that the scholars, for example, that I read in one of those books that I read for the Quetzalcoatl, for the Mayans, is that the scholar said that one of the amazing things about the Popol Vuh is that these things that I mentioned before is the fight between good and evil before the Genesis.
Yeah.
So the Bible doesn't have it. The wisdom, the book of wisdom doesn't have it. The book after death of the Yebichan doesn't have it. The Indian book that I don't remember the name doesn't have it. So just the Popol Vuh consider it. So that's why they consider it it's an amazing book. Okay.
So the fight between good and evil results in good triumphing. What happens to the underworld?
Well, it's not really explained because I think the underworld is clearly still there throughout Maya time. And I think the story functions to explain how people should act in historic times. So it explains how lords should act and they should have certain qualities and values. And so the hero twins are, one of the hero twins is the maize god, who is the god of corn, who is one of the paramount deities of the ancient Maya, and all of the Mesoamerican peoples have a maize deity because maize, beans, and squash were the staff of life. They were this kind of sacred triumvirate of cultigens that their diet was based upon.
But, like here.
Yes, but nothing was more important than maize. And so that fact that is, you know, an economic fact and a cultural fact was read right into the religion. So that one of their paramount deities is a maize deity. So in Mayas clearly believe that the underworld was still there, but the Popol Vuh explains how one could defeat these forces. And they're forces of chaos more than any kind of Judeo-Christian idea of evil.
So maybe the lords of Xibalba are still there and we don't know.
Ball players, watch out.
Yeah.
And after, I would say also, Mary Charlotte, after the hero twins in the first section become the sun and the moon, they is the creation of the first human beings. And they go through several different creations.
Different tries.
Before they hit on the fact that human beings are made of masa, of corn dough, mixed with different kinds of things. And the gods make us in these stories. And sometimes in central Mexico and amongst the Aztecs, the gods leaven this masa with their own blood. At other times, they just model the first humans out of corn. But that was after the second or third time they first try to make people out of mud. That doesn't work.
Then right.
They try to make them out of sticks. That also does not work. And all these previous creations fail and are destroyed in different kinds of cataclysms.
Luis, let's talk a little bit more. I mean, you've got these books that are richly illustrated with your art. And as you said, you went deeply into the Popol Vuh as it came down to us, the version that came down to us, which was a transcription of the original that no longer exists. What was the process by which you came up with the images that are in your books and that we're going to see?
Well, when the publisher called me to do this book, I realized that when I start to read the text, that I was very young for this project. It's because I had to read a lot of the Mayans. The version of the text is written by a Mayan. Actually, he's a professor at University of Davis, Victor Montejo. And he accepted immediately. When he saw my work, he said, okay, we're going to work together. He's one who was giving me the orientations to select the images that are going to be into the book. Okay? But that's one thing. So then it's coming the moment when you start to figure it out how you are going to deal with the images. And like he said before, a long time ago, this has happened a long time ago, even the landscape is changing. It's changing through the years. So sometimes we think that in the way that you see it right now, it was before. No. But you have no choice. You start to create this image for what you see or what you have. Because actually the codex are just the single people in the codex. They're not worried about presenting landscaping and things like that.
So you see images of, for example, the Hero twins in the codex?
I have to.
Yeah.
I had to realize. One amazing thing of those things that I didn't consider is that, for example, when I did Quetzalcoatl, I went to the museum, the archaeology museums in Mexico, the library. It's amazing books. They have a lot of books there. I did all my research by books, by bibliographically, and I start to see the image that they have. I said, this is terrible drawing, so I didn't like them. So I want to do something better. But when I start to look for the real models, okay, and I took the photograph because I work with photograph, I took the photograph to the model, and then I work with the photograph, okay, and I realized, wow, this is my mistake. I didn't consider the kind of drawing that they did before. This is a lot of expressions and movements.
So it was better than you originally thought.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. The things that we work in the Western part, knowledge. They didn't know the Western at that time, so they did codex, and because they have a specific schools to learn how to draw. But the idea was to represent the things that they consider in the daily life. Okay, but it's for example, this image that we see the Popol Vuh that is going to be shown in the exhibition, is the Nanse tree, Nancites. I don't know how to say it in English.
Nanse is a tree that produces these
yellow
little fruits.
Yellow fruits.
Mm-hmm. Little yellow fruits.
So this character used to go to eat every single day Nances to that tree. He stayed in the trunk, okay, in one branch.
But he was like a bird person?
Yeah, it's like seven macaw. Okay, that's why. But the text say, this is when my work is coming, okay, difficult. It's turning difficult. The text say, okay, and the twins were in the middle of the branches, in hiding in the branches, and the seven macaw was in the branches too. When you go to see a real tree of this fruit, there is no way to put all of them together and to try to use the cerbatana, okay, that's kind of
a blowgun,
to throw that little piece of adobe, okay, to hit him. So it it's not too far away. So and then I start to think, to consider a problem for me to do the illustrations. That's when you call the publisher, you call the writer, you got together and you said, we need to change this, okay, because it doesn't work for an illustration to make it real.
Right.
It's easy to write it, because a writer, it doesn't think in how difficult it's going to be for an illustrator or an artist, but it's difficult to illustrate that part. And actually, we are doing a book about extending the giant part of the Popol Vuh. That's the one that I'm finishing right now. And I was very meticulous in that illustration, because one of the bases, like you mentioned before, most of these scenes are on bases, okay? It's that.
So they're both in the codexes, these stories, and the vases.
Yes, they keep them like that.
In fact, just to confuse you even more, these vases that we're talking about are cylinder ceramic vases that the ancient Mayas used to drink chocolate. But as I said, just to confuse you even more, there's a style of vase painting that's called the codex style. And because it looks like the kind of drawing and writing that we see in these manuscripts. But they're on these cylinder ceramic vases.
But the cylinder ceramic vase artists had seen the codex or came from the same traditions that made the codexes?
Same tradition, but most of these ceramics are much earlier than the surviving four Maya books, right? So most of these vases are painted between the year 300 of our era up to about 900. And the four surviving codices are that can be found in Madrid and Dresden and Paris and Mexico City. The Maya codices are all painted after 1100, so they're much later. But what you have to remember is that the ancient Maya world, they were codex, they were manuscript painting schools, just like there were in Europe during the Middle Ages, and they were workshops and associated with great families, like the Duc de Berry's workshop in Burgundy, in France. But they're all thinking about ways to come to grips with how to make images of this great creation story, whether you're doing it on paper, fig bark paper, or in a ceramic format where you have a kind of narrative that wraps around the this cylinder. And so they're both dealing with a text, which was probably communicated both by means of written down and codices, but also particularly in a spoken word. So memorized, just like the Iliad and the Odyssey were originally communicated. So that there's an engagement with performance.
Right.
So there were many dances of the Popol Vuh stories. There were many versions that there must have been recitations of this creation myth or pieces of it at important rituals. And certainly we know that there are accounts in Guatemala during the colonial period, 1600s and 1700s, of Quiche Maya and other Maya groups. There's a Quechi Maya record of a dance of the Popol Vuh, where they recreated some of these episodes, and this, so that it was a living tradition that was, and the books and the ceramics and sometimes some stone sculpture were engaged with some of the episodes in the Popol Vuh.
Now, has any of this come into the present day as, for example, ritual dance tradition and things like that?
When you travel to Mexico, you see all these things, but I don't know how true it is.
How much it's evolved.
Yes, and I asked a professor that he's working on one university in San Felipe del Progreso, Estado de México. He's a vice principal. He's one of my best friends. He's the one who allowed me to do my research in Mexico when I go. And I asked him, because we were traveling around the different places in Mexico, and I asked him, is that true? And so when they start to see the sky and things like that, and he said,
no.
I don't know. I don't know what they feel.
Well, I think that you have to remember that these creation myths, whether it's the Popol Vuh or whether it's this creation mythologies from central Mexico, the Quetzalcoatl story, the feathered serpent story, they're now embraced as kind of universal human patrimony. And so in places in Mexico, like Mexico and Guatemala, where you do have large indigenous populations, or at least where the native peoples have not disappeared, and people are proud of that indigenous heritage in these places, it's no surprise that there is a kind of latter-day Aztec or latter-day Maya or latter-day Toltec expression and culture. And whether or not that's actually really related to the pre-Columbian times, I'm not sure that's that important to know, just as long as you acknowledge that there was a major, a big break there between pre-Columbian times and contemporary Aztec dancers that you can see in Albuquerque or Santa Fe.
Right.
And it's an important cultural phenomenon of today. And those dancers, for example, they're studying the same things that Luis and I'm studying, the same basic sources. Uh-huh. And he's making children's books, and I'm writing articles, and the Aztec dancers are dancing.
Yeah, the thing is that they keep doing this no matter what, but it's they always keep celebrating the sun, looking at the sun when they are dancing, and then they respect the ceremony, how it works, and things like that. So it's good to see them. It's good to see them, to be honest.
But I want to take this in a slightly different direction, which is that, as we just mentioned, the Maya people have not disappeared. And there are more than 20 Maya languages that are spoken in Mesoamerica today. Mm-hmm. That is southern Mexico, all of Guatemala, all of Belize, western Salvador, and western Honduras. And This is just in the Yucatan Peninsula alone, there are more than 2 million speakers of Yucatec Maya. So the people are not gone. What has been happening in the last 30 years is there has been some meaningful connection between scholars and students of the ancient cultures and living people. So more than anything, in some parts of Mexico and Guatemala, there are really active native groups who have now been learning how to write Maya hieroglyphic writing again.
Yeah, they
have for the first time that you have not native Maya people who can write the names of their ancient rulers using ancient Maya hieroglyphics again for the first time in 1,000 years, and that's a powerful thing to give a people their history back.
Yes.
And particularly in place in some of the countries of that of this region, there has been a really difficult relationship between the national regimes and the native peoples. And in many places, this culture was systematically erased for a number of reasons, both political and religious, over the last 500 years. And now the Maya people, whether they're in Guatemala or Yucatan, are now saying, no, we have more power now. We should be able to control some aspect of this, or at least, at the very least, teach our children about the names of these important mythological figures or the rulers of these ancient Maya cities whose names we can read in their original language today.
Yeah. When we were wanting to publish this book of the Popol Vuh in Spanish, not in English, the version in Spanish, the publisher need to send it to the school, the house of the languages, Mayan languages. They correct all the single words that they said, this is not the way that it has to be. It has to be written in this way. So it's a very powerful now. Things has to be, they're really taking a good care of their heritage, okay? And it's one of the things, the languages, of course.
Yeah.
They survive. They're still there and they're getting control of many things now. They're doing better and better and better.
Here you are having written these books and illustrated these books on Mesoamerican creation stories, Popol Vuh. People are taking this as their own culture, people who have been colonized and are in some kind of process of maybe trying to uncolonize themselves or live in a more multicultural way in terms of how they see themselves, as you say, relearning languages and writing systems and things like that are very deeply part of their heritage. And I wonder how these mythologies affect or change the way people see themselves, the way they live, the way they think.
You have an idea?
No. They are around. They are doing good things individually. If you go to Guatemala, you see a lot of people who is 67% of the population is Mayans, maybe. And but most of them, they're still looking down when you see a person who is mestizo or whatever. It happened to me when I was in Mexico doing the research for Quetzalcoatl. And I was invited to eat the publisher owner at their house and to meet the writer. And we started, and the servant came. And I tried to say hello because I'm a very open person. I don't care where you're coming from or who you are. And the lady never answered to me, that woman. She
looked down.
She looks down. And you go to all the different towns in Mexico, Altiplano, for example, and they look down to you. They no look at you face to face. But this is coming maybe because of the history. Because when Moctezuma met Cortes, for example, Moctezuma look at him and all the people has to be looking down. I don't know if that or maybe because they feel inferior because of the history of what happened with the mestizos against them.
Yeah.
But to be honest, sometimes talking to this vice principal, who is my friend Luis too, he said that it's very difficult to work with them because they don't trust us.
They don't trust you. Yeah.
When they come to talk to us, or we go to talk to them and to offer things and things like that, they always look down or look different directions. They don't look at your face, and they don't believe what you are saying, if it's true or not. So he said it's the difficult part to be dealing with these people right now at this moment, with all these Indian groups of cultures.
Well, I think that there's such a long history of oppression, racism, mm-hmm. and in all of these countries that people have learned that there could be really negative consequences if they challenge authority. But mm-hmm. that the other question that you were mm-hmm. asking about how people are people living these myths. And I do think that there certainly are places in Mexico and Guatemala in which people have not forgotten these stories. And so some of the aspects of the worldview that are encoded in these stories are so baked into people's culture, particularly if you speak one of these Maya languages, that you may be talking about some of the ideas in the Popol Vuh and not even know you're talking about them on a daily basis. And so I think that they're, as the Mayas, as the different Maya groups become more powerful and as they begin to join together to explore their culture and assert their rights, I do think that the Popol Vuh will become more important, but certainly it is a kind of project of in some respects, of rescue, to reintroduce some of the stories into areas. So just as many languages are in danger around the world, yeah. some of these cultural traditions have also been endangered by 500 years of colonization and everything that goes along with that.
The reason I asked that question was because I was introduced once to an Inca creation story in which a city was founded that ended up being the city of Cusco, and the people there before the founding of the city were basically living in very dire conditions and eating the fruit off the trees, and they were introduced to farming and agriculture and animal husbandry, and their lives got better. And I was thinking about that in comparison to the biblical Genesis creation story in which people were eating the fruit off the trees and that was paradise. And then they ate the fruit of the tree of knowledge and they learned to toil in the fields and that was a punishment. And so the stories were so, to me, so opposed to each other. In one story, agriculture was a reward. In the other story, it was a punishment. And I thought, well, no wonder you have to have a work ethic in a world where work is a punishment, and not so much in a world where that kind of work is considered a reward. And your creation stories, perhaps, I mean, that just sent me on a line of thinking that creation stories are very powerful in the way that you see the things and live the things that they say, like work.
Well, the Popol Vuh explains why maize is so important in the traditional society. So it links it to the creation story. It links it to creator deities. It links it to the basic ideas about the origin of human beings. And so if corn is so important in your diet and in your culture, then there's no surprise that we should be able to track it or map it in all of these other arenas of culture. And that's a good example. I think corn is essential or maize in the story of the Popol Vuh.
Yeah, the Quetzalcoatl is how it started. It's coming from the plant of corn, so it's how they create all this concept. I mean, the snake and the feathers, and so on. Before they started, the Olmecas, 15 centuries before Jesus Christ, they started with the jaguar, because the jaguar was stronger for them, animal on the earth. Okay. And it's more botanical part, and they start to create these ideas because they said, okay, we are becoming a civilization. We have this grain, it's a cereal. Okay, it's the one we need to continue growing and living, so we have to protect it. So this is how they started with the corn. So it's very important that he said.
Let's talk for a moment about the Quetzalcoatl legend. I mean, it's the feathered snake. What is the meaning of this, or what is the origin of this image?
Yeah, this is the snake represents the water for them. It's the movement, and they knew that the plant need water to grow. Okay, but at the same time, they need to unify the plant with the sky. Why? Because it's the sky where the water come from when the rain, things like that. You know, so they needed a bird. In this case, it appears Quetzal. So because the feathers are so beautiful. And some other scholars said that the feathers represent all the leaves of those plants when they're growing. So if you go into a milpa, you see a lot of green leaves, okay? And that's supposed to represent the for some of them. So some other people think about other concepts behind that. But it's the snake is first because of the water, and then it's coming the, but before it was the jaguar, like I said before, because it was defending the earth. The jaguar represent the enter of the earth, because the grain you had to bury it, and it has to be there for a certain time until it starts to grow. So that's life for them. That's the represent of life. At the same time, is how they are going to feel as a new civilization. But at the same time, is the concept of life return all the time. You know, to be continuous with this with the war in the world.
Quetzalcoatl, it's an Aztec word or Nahuatl word that means Quetzal snake, and it's an impossible creature. Right, it's a creature that has feathers, and it's based upon a rattlesnake, but a rattlesnake that has feathers. And some of these, and there are many kinds of snakes in ancient Mesoamerican religion. Some of them have legs. Some of them are like dragons. Many of them are, as Luis said, are sky beings and water beings. And this feathered serpent is associated with water and the wind also.
Yeah,
and
they
fly through the sky, and they're not at all like snakes in Judeo-Christian theology, which are symbols of evil. So these are much closer to some of the snakes that we have here in the Southwest, like the horned serpent, the Avanyu, that's found in many of the cultures here, mm-hmm. Which is associated with lightning and water and rain, and not with any kind of negative concept. But Quetzalcoatl was a very important deity in ancient Mesoamerica that was worshipped by all of the Mesoamerican cultures.
So all of this is part of your imagery, Luis Garay, which you will be showing this Friday.
Yes.
And that runs through the whole month. Now, children's books, are they always in the form of children's books? Is that the context for all
well,
of these pieces?
At this moment right now, when people ask me what I do, I say I do illustrations for book. I don't say anymore I do illustrations for children's books. Because actually, since the beginning, I always choose topics who are not very common in the Western industry of children books. It's immigration, social issues, ancestors. So it's for me now, it's like, say, I illustrate books, that's it, okay? It's not for children, it's for anyone.
Yeah.
And it's working that way. It's just a very defined kind of work that any person can enjoy it, to see it and to understand it. And the idea is to simplify it, to make it understandable through the image, okay? Because if we do a book like the scholars do, it's more complicated.
No footnotes, right? Well, I think that the annual theme for the Santa Fe Art Institute this year is immigration.
Mm-hmm. Which we haven't even talked about yet, but yeah. It's almost time to go. So.
But and you've brought some of those images as well.
Yes, it's going to be presented at the show, my first book, The Long Road.
Right. Okay. So The Long Road is the children's book about immigration, and then there's books on the Popol Vuh and Quetzalcoatl. Mm-hmm. And the exhibition is called Creation Myths of Mesoamerica. It opens this Friday, the 6th of May at 5 o'clock, and is on view at the Santa Fe Art Institute Monday through Friday from 9 to 5 through the 27th of May. And there is a talk between these two gentlemen called The Intersection of Mythology and Immigration. That is on Thursday, the 12th of May, so that's a special event at 7 in the evening, and people can come for that. All of these are free and open to the public. Luis Garay is an artist and illustrator from Nicaragua. Cristán Villela is a professor of art history at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.